You are listening to A Scary State,
a podcast where every week we talk about all things scary in your state.
From killers
to haunted locations,
cryptids
to urban legends,
and everything scary in between.
We're two friends who share a passion for haunted stories and true crime.
And you never know what scary secrets your state holds.
So, Lauren.
Yes, Nora.
Let's get scary. Hi, everyone. It's Nora.
And Lauren.
Welcome back for episode numero cuatro.
Good job, Nora.
Thank you. So I'm feeling a lot better because I actually got my second COVID shot yesterday afternoon.
Woohoo!
And literally right after, the nurse looks at me in the eyes and says, you can only take Tylenol. So I was like, oh, no problem. I get home. My head's killing me. I search the house for an hour for Tylenol. Can't find any. Finally, I find one Tylenol pill. Gosh knows if it's expired, but I take it anyways. And then I realized I still don't have any, but as normal, I'm running like an hour late to Lauren's house. So luckily she had some because she basically takes care of me. So that's where we're at today. And my head doesn't hurt anymore.
I literally always have Tylenol on me, and everyone at work knows that if they have a headache to come to Lauren because she always has Tylenol.
Oh my gosh. And you know, I kind of felt bad because like I didn't even text you before to see if you had it because I just knew you did. So I just show up like, can I have some Tylenol?
I'm glad I could help.
Thank you for that. Today we're going to be taking you to New York State. New York, nicknamed the Empire State, joined the Union on July 9, 1776, and became the 11th state in the U.S. It was one of the 13 original colonies. In 1624, the lower part of New York was named New Amsterdam after the Dutch settlers who came to the area. But when England finally gained control in 1664, they renamed it New York after the Duke of York.
Ooh.
Some interesting New York laws. It is illegal to honk your horn in New York City.
Oh, yeah, because that never happens.
I know. I'm like, we need to, like, quit our jobs and move there and just give people tickets for honking their horns make millions of dollars.
We would never have to work again.
I know. You could end up paying a $25 fine for flirting.
Oh.
I don't know if that one's enforced either, but it's a law.
Again, one of those things where how did this law come about?
I know. It's illegal for two or more people to meet in public while wearing a mask.
Uh-oh. COVID times.
Awkward. It's illegal to put your thumb on your nose and wiggle your fingers. Someone must have been bullied as a child and they like, got into a position of power and were like, you can't do that anymore. And then Washington Square Park used to be an old potter's field where 20,000 criminals and poor people were buried. So you're walking on top of graves.
Ew.
Bryant Park, Madison Square Park, and Union Square Park all used to be cemeteries.
Did we go to any of those places when we went to New York?
I don't think so, but my dad actually went to Bryant High School in Queens, so I wonder if that's like the same park.
Oh.
It's really, I like know really weird facts like that about people.
Oh no, but I love that.
I know, so I'm going to have to ask him. Speaking of, there were actually 1,800 cemeteries in New York State.
Jeez.
Tarrytown was the inspiration for the tale of Sleepy Hollow.
Hmm.
In New York, there have been 12 identified serial killers and 2 unidentified serial killers.
Jeez.
Yeah.
That's a lot.
That is. Per the FBI's definition from Wikipedia, a serial killing is defined as a series of 2 or more murders committed as separate events, usually, but not always, by one offender acting alone. According to research from Bradford University,
hey Virginia,
oh, yeah. and Florida Gulf Coast University, New York is one of the top 5 states with the largest number of serial killer victims at 628 since 1900. Gosh.
That's crazy.
I know. I mean, it doesn't really shock me just because there's so many people confined in New York City alone. But when you look at those numbers, it's scary.
Yeah. All right. Well, today I really wanted to find a disappearance for some reason, but I like couldn't find any that's, I don't know, like I just couldn't find like the right one.
Yeah.
So I was like, all right, I'm going to do a like shallow dive and do a couple different cases. So I'm doing disappearances in the Adirondacks.
I can't wait. I'm so excited.
So just a little background on the Adirondacks. It's a mountain range in northeastern New York State. The state of New York created the Adirondack Park in 1982, and it's protected by state law, so most of the mountains are not settled. So there are parts that are private and parts that are public. It's 6 million acres. made up of 12 regions.
Excuse me?
Right? That's almost like, I like can't even comprehend 6 million acres.
That's massive.
So in those 6 million acres, they have more than 2,000 miles of hiking trails, over 3,000 lakes and ponds, and 1,200 miles of rivers. So the mountain summits can range in height from 1,200 feet to 5,000 feet. And 46 of those peaks are called the high peaks because their summits are all above 4,000 feet. So Mount Marcy is the tallest peak, reaching 5,344 feet above sea level. This is also where Lake Tear of the Clouds is located, which is the highest lake in New York at 4,292 feet. The mountains are known for some of the best skiing on the East Coast because between October-ish November time and March-ish April-ish time, they get about 15 to 30 inches of snow falling a month. Much of the Adirondacks are maintained by the Department of Environmental Conservation and the Adirondack Mountain Club. So a fun fact, the Adirondack / North County region has averaged 84 searches a year since 2006, with nearly all of them being successful. And they say that the first 48 hours after a hiker goes missing are the most critical. So even though that sounds like a really nice stat, there are still a lot of people who have gone missing while out enjoying nature.
Oh my gosh.
So I'm going to go over a couple of the people who have gone missing and just like shallow dives into their cases. So Jack Coloni, I hope I'm saying the last name right, was last seen on June 6th, 2006, as he set out for an 8 to 10 day camping trip. He was going by himself. He checked in when he got there on June 6th, and he said he was going to be checking out June 14th. He was going to the Moose River Plains Wild Forest, which is one of the more remote regions of the Adirondacks, and it's known for its rough and challenging terrain. So the forest is in an area that is so dense that the average pace of travel is only half a mile per hour.
That's how I walk normally. I'm going to have to exercise. Sorry.
And they say it's hard to see someone who is just 5 feet away from you. So a ranger was out fishing one day on June 14th when he passed by Coloni's campsite. And he came back 2 days later on June 16th and noticed that nothing had changed, which kind of struck him as odd, so he notified his supervisors. Mm-hmm. A search began on June 17th. So after a 10-day search, they searched 35 square miles. They had over 4,000 man hours recorded, and really nothing was found. On day two of their search, a red kayak was found, but it wasn't confirmed to be Coloni's. They just, you know, found a red kayak. It's believed that he went missing 3 to 4 days after he first set up camp on June 6th. So an interesting fact is that 80% of missing hikers usually turn up within a 3-mile radius of their last known location. But again, in these woods, it's so dense that you're only traveling half a mile per hour. So 3 miles is a pretty far distance.
Yeah.
This area, which is between the Blue Mountain Lake, Indian Lake, and West Canada Lake Wilderness area, has accounted for a, quote, disproportionately high number of missing hikers.
Oh my goodness.
So Thomas Aiken, a forest ranger, calls this area the Bermuda Triangle, like Bermuda, Bermuda. It's because, quote, it's just because over the years we've had so many searches that have been extended searches in this area, meaning that the search went on for multiple days and it wasn't just those first couple 48 hours that someone's found.
Mm-hmm.
So I found like a ton of different people who have gone missing just in this exact area. So in August 1951, E.F. Cumley was a 69-year-old man and former mayor who went missing. A 17-day search revealed absolutely nothing. 6 years later, only his personal belongings were found. June 1990, David Boomhauer went missing. He was a 38-year-old man from Latham, New York. Again, sorry if I pronounced that wrong.
Yeah.
His body was found 4 months later.
Oh.
October 1992, David Wolchin, a 60-year-old man from Queens, went missing, and his remains were found 3.5 years later, less than a half a mile from where he was last seen.
Are you kidding me? Did they, like, not search hard enough, or?
Like they said, it's where this area is so dense that you won't see someone 5 feet in front of you.
Oh my gosh. You
could literally be walking next to their body and not realize that it's there,
oh.
Which is common, like a common thing I read about in a lot of the stories, which is terrifying. On May 2006, 2 months before Coloni went missing, George LaForest went missing. A two-week search took place, but nothing was found at all. June 2007, two hikers found the tent of Irene Horn, a wanderer who had spent time in and out of prison. The tent had been collapsed for what was believed to be 2 to 3 years with no sign of Horn since.
Oh.
November 1971, George Bombardier went missing. He is the longest running unsolved disappearance in the forest. And that was just to name a few. There are about 9 other hikers who have been reported missing in this area as well. Wow. And I can see why it's so easy to go missing. So Joe and I went hiking once. Wow. And I know, right? At the beginning of our relationship, I had to show I was athletic. Aww. So we're hiking and we choose like the easy trail, which is like the blue trail. And mm-hmm. so you just follow different trees that have like blue spray painted on them. Mm-hmm. So we're following them. It's starting to get dark. We're going downhill. We know we're almost done. And then mm-hmm. all of a sudden the blue trees just disappear. We cannot find a single blue tree anywhere. Oh, we don't know like what way we're supposed to go. We don't know if we should follow another color because we don't know how long that path is. Like, and it's getting dark and it's creepy. But thankfully, we were in a place where, like, there's a road that leads you to the top of the mountain. So mm-hmm. we literally just followed the road down to get to our car.
Oh, thank
but it
goodness.
Was, like, really terrifying. So I can't even imagine being in a place like the Adirondacks where it's not like that, where there's colored trees to follow.
Yeah, and I imagine, like, you know, back when some of those were happening in the 90s and mm-hmm. earlier, they didn't have cell phones. They didn't right. know. They couldn't just call someone. They probably had a map and maybe a compass, and that's terrifying.
Yeah.
Because it's already harder to hike there than normal.
So even with us, like, we found the road and, like, took the road down, which was yeah. super easy. But, like, if there's no road there, like, I don't know what would have happened.
Yeah. Well, I mean, and I think about, we have a friend who
oh my God.
Went hiking a few years ago. And let me just preface this by saying that she's not, like, an outdoorsy type. I don't know how they convinced her to go on a hike.
But
she
I
went
don't
with some
either.
Guys and they somehow convinced her. And they ended up getting so lost. They were lost for hours. It was, I mean, I think people's phones were dying. I think it was 4 of them.
Yeah.
She's trying to tell them where to go. They're not listening.
It's getting dark out.
Yep. And they had to call a park ranger to come find them.
I completely forgot about that when I was doing my notes.
I remember her telling me the story, and she was like, I was in pain for like a week after because she was like walking for so long. And you know, that's a lot on someone. Like a 2-hour hike can be a lot on you.
And so now our hikes as a group consist of going on the WNOD trail.
Which is like not a hike in DC.
Completely flat pavement where yeah. people run and where they're hiking away.
And you would have to be intoxicated or something to get drunk on or to get lost on it. Excuse me. So.
But yeah, so nothing was found on Colony. So then I'm going to talk about Stephen Paul Thomas. So I'm going to refer to him as Thomas. He was 19 at the time and was last seen on April 12th, 1976 on Mount Marcy. And that was the tallest peak in the Adirondacks that I mentioned. So he went out hiking with a group of 5 other college students. He was friends with 2 of the students, Bruce Weaver and Kenneth Shearwood. But reportedly, he didn't like the other 3 group members. And since they were hiking in April, and due to the extreme weather changes that this mountain experiences, April is the toughest month to hike this part of the mountain. So what I found interesting as I was reading was the previous morning, his mother was baking pancakes and added too much baking soda, which she saw as a bad omen, which is like really spooky
that
knowing what happens.
Super spooky.
Yeah. So I didn't like that very much. Mm-mm. So Bruce and Thomas started on April 11th at a different spot than the other 4. And they were all 6 going to meet up on April 12th to continue the rest of the hike together. So April 11th goes off fine. April 12th comes, and at 3:30 p.m., they decided to call it a day and make camp. So they were close to the summit, maybe like a mile away, but wanted to rest, eat, and tackle it the next day to have the whole day to get to the summit. Well, Thomas wasn't done yet and wanted to continue on.
Drama.
Right? But no one else in the group wanted to continue. So at one point, Bruce is like making tea, and Thomas asks if he wants to go for a walk, and Bruce denies. So Thomas told the group he was going to go on his own then. So the group protested, but Thomas went anyway.
No, he didn't
bring
Thomas.
I know. He didn't bring any equipment or food with him, and he left wearing only a yellow rain jacket over a blue down jacket, and the blue down jackets are kind of like your wintry jacket. 6 p.m. came around, and Thomas had still not returned, but Bruce told the group not to worry. He knew that he stated that Thomas knew what he was doing. He was fine. He'd be back. So 10 p.m. comes around. There's still no word from Thomas. So Robert and Bruce decided to set out to try and find him, but that didn't last very long because the weather conditions were horrible. Temperatures were down to 10 degrees. There were 50 to 60 mile per hour wind gusts with a wind chill of negative 40. And so at negative 40, if you have any skin exposed, like, you're at risk for frostbite immediately.
Oh, no. And they're probably like, oh, we told him not to go. That's the last thing they want to be doing. They're probably mm-hmm. not thinking the worst yet. But then yeah. once the temperature drops, that gets really
So they couldn't go any farther, so they had to go back to their camp. And what was weird that night was they brought a dog with them, and they said that the dog was crying and whining the entire night and wouldn't leave the tent, like, that entire night. Mm. And they said that was very, very weird behavior. The next morning, April 13th, the group decided to continue looking for Thomas, but found absolutely no trace of him. It had been very windy that night, so any tracks that he could have had were just completely gone. So by 8:45 p.m., three of the group members find a park ranger named Gary Hodgson and reported Thomas missing. So because of the conditions on this mountain, searchers weren't able to reach the, like, where they were on the mountain until the morning of April 14th. So after that, a huge two-week search commenced, including efforts from the Department of Environmental Conservation rangers and volunteers, dogs, the state police, and the Air Force. So the five other hikers were questioned by authorities because they were, you know, the prime suspects, right. But they were quickly ruled out. No sign of Thomas has been found. So some believe that he went off on his own purposefully. Mm-hmm. He had just returned from a month-long Western trip that he had taken, and he kept hinting at his future plans, but he was super secretive and wasn't telling anyone what those future plans were. So people think that he might have just wanted to go off on his own, but his family mm-hmm. stated that he wouldn't intentionally leave without telling them. The most yeah. common theory, though, is that he got lost or hurt or injured or something and died of exposure and hypothermia.
That's what I think it was.
But a weird thing. So weeks after his disappearance, a cassette had been pushed into the tape deck of his car, and the song that was playing, they believe, was called Obscured by Clouds, and the song ends with the lyrics, "All you hear is the blowing, the lonely wind blowing."
Wait, I'm sorry, did you say clowns?
Clouds.
Oh, thank goodness.
But yeah, so I was like, oh, well, I'm going to find these lyrics. I could not find the song anywhere. So I don't know how true Obscured by Clouds is. Mm-hmm. I looked up that song and those lyrics weren't anywhere in it. I looked up those lyrics and couldn't find a song. So I don't know. So the next case I'm going to talk about is Colin Gillis. So Colin was an 18-year-old college student from sunny Brockport returning home during spring break in Tupper Lake. Tupper Lake is, like, within Adirondack Park.
Mm-hmm.
He returned home on March 9th, you know, from school, college, at spring break.
Yeah.
And on March 10th, 2012, around 8:30 p.m., Colin went out to a party with some of his high school friends. And though it was spring break, it's still cold as it is here, mm-hmm. so the temperatures were down in the teens. So after hopping around to a few different parties throughout the night, Gillis and his group of nine friends ended up at a final party, one that they actually hadn't been invited to.
Ooh.
And I'm thinking, you're rolling up to this party with 10 people and none of you were invited.
Especially if it's all guys. Like, good luck.
Yeah, so I don't know. Apparently they were fine for a while, but at some point an argument did break out and there was a physical altercation. So after this, the group decided it was just best if they left.
Yeah.
But Colin refused to leave and was adamant about staying. Even though his friends tried to convince him to leave with them, they told him they'd go find another party, they'd go do something, he was adamant about staying.
Oh.
So it's believed that he left the party around 1 p.m. The party did eventually break up at 1:30, so not very long after he left.
Mm-hmm.
But it is believed that there was more than one fight that had occurred that night and that Colin may have been involved in one of those.
Mm.
So I'm totally going to butcher this road name. So the party was off of Pascungame Road.
Whoa.
That sounded really good.
Nailed that. I think you did great for whatever it was.
Thank you. And this road is a very steep, rural, winding road. So there are no sidewalks or streetlights on the road. Its trees are on each side, so there's no shoulder or anything on these roads.
Oh, no.
And it's reported that at the top of this road is New York 3. And at this point, Colin should have turned right, which would lead him back to his house. But instead, he turned left, which led to a town called Piercefield, which is the opposite direction of his home in Tupper Lake. Around 1:30, which is when they believe the party pretty much ended,
mm-hmm.
one of Colin's friends drove by while he was walking on the road and asked if he wanted a ride, but Colin said no and informed his friend that he was waiting for a ride from a different friend.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, his friend drives off, does whatever he needs to do, and is driving back and sees Colin again and asks him again, like, do you need a ride? And Colin mm-hmm. said, nope, I have a friend who's on his way. So it was speculated that the friend that he was waiting for lives in Piercefield, which could be why he was walking in that direction to meet up with him sooner. So instead okay. of staying in one spot and freezing, he was just going to keep walking until he, like, ran into his friend kind of thing.
Right.
But New York 3 is more populated than Pascungame Road, but still doesn't have streetlights or sidewalks, but it does have a shoulder with a guardrail. So he was seen by a driver named Rich Rossentretter at 1:45 a.m. on the road. Rich reported that Colin was not wearing a jacket, even though it was very cold outside that night, like I said, in the teens. Mm-hmm. Rich wasn't able to stop as he had his elderly mother in the car with him, and he just did not feel safe stopping for a random person with his old mom in the car. Right. But when he got home shortly after that, he called the police immediately and told him what he saw. So a state trooper was dispatched to go search the road, but he didn't get there for 40 minutes after the call.
Oh.
But when he did get to the location that Rich had reported seeing Colin, he drove up and down these, like, a couple mile stretch of the road over and over and could not find Colin anywhere. So he was reported missing the next day. A massive search was conducted that following day, with search efforts coming from the Department of Environmental Conservation, the New York State Police, state missing persons organizations, and local volunteer fire departments and EMS squads. So the search resulted in two of Colin's items being recovered on New York 3, his driver's license and a tobacco pipe. More than 10,000 man hours of searching was, you know, happening, but nothing was found. Police also received around 500 leads, all of which they followed up on, but nothing gave them any additional information.
Mm.
But on November 12, 2020, the Adirondack Daily Enterprise posted an article. So they had a new development in the case that led the state police to the town of Edwards, quote, where they were seen digging on Tuesday. So State Police Public Information Officer Trooper Jennifer Feisman, just imagine having to write that on all of your documents. Like, I'm public police, State Police Public Information Officer Trooper.
Anywho. I feel like some people love their titles, though, so they don't mind.
Oh, yeah.
It just depends on, you know, who you are.
Oh, yeah. So she stated, we were following up on a lead in Edwards on the Gillis case. No arrests have been made. We are following up on an older lead. So that's all the information they have of this case that happened so many years ago.
Wow.
But they do ask if you have any information to call the New York State Police at 518-897-2000. So now we're going to go over Douglas Legg. So he went by Dougie. He was an 8-year-old who disappeared on July 10th, 1971. His family was staying at Camp Santinoni, which is a 12,900-acre part of the Adirondacks.
Wow.
Which, again, the sizes just blow my mind.
But it's like a drop in the water of the millions of acres.
Right. So Douglas was known to be a keen hiker and a mini woodsman, as he and his family had spent so many summers here. So they literally went here every single summer. Oh. And this was the last year they were going. After this, they were going to kind of stop going as often. Mm-hmm. I think Douglas was the grandson of the owner of this camp.
Okay.
So the family decided to take a hike and in a part of the woods that they knew very well.
Mm-hmm.
So on Saturday, July 10th at 3:30 p.m., as they were hiking, they came upon a patch of poison ivy. Well, Douglas wasn't wearing the proper pants, so his uncle told him to quickly run back to the lodge and change into good pants and come back up with them.
Mm-hmm.
So he runs back towards the lodge. He was last seen about 50 to 60 yards away from the main lodge by his cousin and brother, but that was the last time he was ever seen. So search efforts began that night to find him. Close to 1,000 volunteers came out to help search. They had the Army, the Marine Corps, the Air Force. They used heat-seeking equipment to try to find his body. Nothing. A hound was able to track his scent, but it ended at the edge of a pond. So that pond was drained and searched, but Dougie wasn't found. 5 days into the search, shoe prints were found about 2 miles away from that pond, but the weather had been bad and the dogs couldn't pick up any more of a scent. 80 square miles had been covered in that six-week search. The search lasted 33 days, but sign of Douglas has been found. It's believed that there wasn't foul play, though there are always those rumors that believe it was.
Mm-hmm.
And some interesting maybe leads. In 1993, a woman called officials claiming that Douglas's body would be found in a lake in Lewis County. She claimed that he had been kidnapped and killed by a relative of hers and that his body had been dumped in the lake. So, of course, the lake was drained and nothing was found.
Mm.
It was later learned that the woman was a psychiatric patient and suffered from false memory syndrome.
Oh, my God.
And that's pretty much exactly what it is, where you have a memory and you think it's a true memory, but it's not because it's the syndrome that she had.
Yeah.
Which is really sad.
I know.
So around that same time, a man came forward, stated that in 1973, he had been hunting with a friend, and he had come across a small skull and partial skeleton that he believed to be human. He said he had been chasing deer on a peninsula that led to Newcomb Lake. So that area was about a half a mile from the lodge where Douglas had been staying.
Mm-hmm.
The man stated that he didn't come forward at the time because he was in the Navy on leave and wasn't where he reported he would be, so he could get in a lot of trouble. Like, when my brother was in the military, if he was on leave, he had to say exactly where he would be, the exact time he would be there. Like, they're very, very strict. If you go anywhere else, you're considered AWOL. So the man also didn't know about the case at the time. But this story does make sense because it believed that Dougie was trying to follow his uncle around Newcomb Lake. So police believe that he might have walked across the peninsula thinking he was next to the lake near his uncle, but then got disoriented and lost. So this island was searched, but due to the thick vegetation, the search didn't accomplish much. His disappearance, though, thankfully did lead to a change in the organization and efficiency of search and rescue missions in the Adirondacks. So as horrible as it is, at least it did have some sort of a silver lining.
Yeah.
They also say if you have information to call the state police at 518-897-2044.
Oh, poor Dougie.
8 years old.
I know. And he was probably so scared, like, whatever happened.
Because they believe that he, like, was following his uncle on the lake and then walked up onto the peninsula that the guy had been hunting on many years before. And that's what they think happened. Like, he found himself on this little island and just didn't know what to do.
Oh, his uncle has to live with that for the rest of his life, too.
I can't even imagine.
I know.
So then we have Thomas Messick. So Thomas Messick was 82 years old when he disappeared on November 15th, 2015. He was out hunting with a group of six other friends and family on Sunday the 15th. They were hunting near Lily Pond in a part of the Adirondacks called Lake George Wild Forest. The group had a plan where Messick would be standing at one location, and the younger hunters would walk through the woods scaring the deer to him. Mm-hmm. So when they reached the predetermined location where Messick was supposed to be, he was nowhere to be found. So he was a paratrooper in the U.S. military with the 82nd Airborne, and he was, quote, an experienced hunter and woodsman and taught hunter and survival training for many years. So it's kind of concerning how he disappeared in the woods where he knows what he's doing.
And he would know, like, how to react to situations where you or I would panic.
Oh, yeah. He did have limited hearing and vision problems, though, from his time in the Army. And what's incredibly sad is he recently had shingles and almost decided not to go on the trip because of it, because he was still kind of recovering from it, but he decided to go anyways. So he was last seen at 10 a.m., and when his group reached his predetermined location, didn't see him, they called the forest rangers immediately and searched until 4:30 p.m. that evening. At 7 p.m., there was still no sight of him, and part of the group remained to try and find Messick, but the other half left to contact authorities. So the group that stayed behind said they were honking their horns and calling out to him and making a ton of noise to hopefully draw him to them, but that didn't work. So a search for him began the next day on November 16th. Over 300 professionals and volunteers were involved in the search, with more than 10,000 man hours spent searching. More than 15 agencies were involved, including DEC forest rangers, DEC police canine units, DEC police officers, FBI quick response team, a state police special operations response team, the Warren County Sheriff's Office tactical team, and volunteers from the New York State Federation of Search and Rescue Teams.
They called the whole squad.
They just everyone. So more than a 4-square-mile area was searched by people, while the larger area was searched by those in helicopters. During the search, though, what the SAR teams described, they said that there were absolutely no sounds of wildlife in the forest at the time, which is, like, super spooky.
What?
Like, you know, in every horror movie, they're walking through and they're like, you know what I haven't heard? Like, animals. Like, if you don't hear animals in the woods, that's terrifying.
Gosh.
And the SARS team, so the search and rescue team, they even said on their own, like, that was creepy. So the search concluded that following January. No signs of Tom were found, even though he had with him a rifle and a walkie-talkie. So nothing has been found, not his rifle, not his walkie-talkie. Gosh. They believe that he may have gotten lost, but they're confused of how he would have gotten that far, and at his old age, how he was mobile enough to get anywhere that far. Mm-hmm. The FBI usually doesn't assist in search and rescue cases. They're only involved if foul play is suspected, and they were here. Which makes you kind of wonder why they're here for just a simple search and rescue case.
Yeah.
So it's weird that on day 4 of his disappearance, November 19th, the FBI showed up. So Beverly, Tom's wife, stated, quote, "The FBI told me something isn't right with his case, but they don't know what. They won't share any theories if they have them. The FBI said until they make a discovery, they're never going to know." So Beverly believes it may have been foul play. She stated that if he got lost, he would have cut a piece of his jacket and tied it to a tree. So if he had gotten lost on his own accord, he would have tied something to a tree. If he were kidnapped or there was any foul play, he wouldn't have had time to leave it.
Right.
So a witness at the time had claimed to hear a strange noise about the time they believed Thomas disappeared. He said, quote, "I heard a strange noise in the woods, but I don't know what it was. Just a different noise from what I usually hear, you know. It'd be hard to explain because, but it was different. Something different that I never heard before in the woods. I just can't say what it was, you know? It was up towards the hill, the top of the hill. Yeah. So it's still classified as an open investigation. After, like, all these years later. So it's just terrifying. So while the Adirondacks are beautiful, disappearances seem all too common in these mountains. It's just terrifying.
And, you know, that most recent case, the 82-year-old man, yes. I have a feeling it was foul play. Mm-hmm. Just given, I mean, it would be one thing if he had dementia or some sort of mental illness that started later in life. But he didn't. And he was trained in how to react in those situations. That just doesn't sit right with me.
And when you're in the military, you go out into the field and you learn field survival and you learn what to do if you're
it's like an instinct.
In the woods. Yes, he was in the military. So with him being in the military, his experience would have been something that he carried with him his entire life.
Right.
So the fact that like he didn't leave any clues, that he didn't leave any markings of him, that he wasn't able to get out of it, there's something very shady with that.
Well, I can tell you where I'm not vacationing this year. not going there.
Yep. When we go up to visit New York again, we'll just stay in the city.
Yeah. That's kind of my style. Just ticket people for honking their horns.
The concrete jungle, not the other scary jungles.
Yeah, exactly.
All right. What are you telling us, Nora?
So I'm going to be talking about the unsolved murder of Kristen O'Connell.
Ooh.
And I just want to kind of start by saying that it was hard to find information on this case. I don't know if it just didn't get the right publicity. It seems like all of the information came from a single news source, which was in Rochester, their channel News 11. So that was a little frustrating, but I felt like the case was so important that I wanted to still talk about it and kind of present the information I found. This case takes place in the town of Ovid, which is in Seneca County, which is in the Finger Lakes of upstate New York.
Okay, I'm sorry. Have you ever seen The Office?
Yeah.
Okay, so there's one episode where Michael leaves and they're trying to find a new regional manager, and it's played by Jim Carrey, and he just goes, "I have a vacation in the Finger Lakes. You know, a lot of people go missing in the Finger Lakes. I told my family I was on a hike. I haven't been back. It's been 3 hours. I really have to go to the Finger Lakes." It just... Whenever I hear that, like the Finger Lakes, I just immediately think of The Office.
I mean, it is kind of a creepy name. Like the Finger Lakes.
But yeah.
This particular area of the Finger Lakes, which is Ovid, is located between Seneca Lake and Cayuga Lake, which are the two largest of the Finger Lakes. So people from Rochester area and other nearby towns often vacation in the Finger Lakes. And, you know, the rich folk will have some homes there. They'll take their boats out on the lakes. It's just a really nice area to vacation, whether or not you know, are bougie about it or just go to rent for the weekend. So the population was a little over 2,700 people at the year 2000 census. So it's a pretty small lake town for the most part.
Mm-hmm.
The town is named after the Roman poet Ovid, and a town clerk actually came up with the name who was interested in classic Roman poetry. If you look at the Finger Lakes on a map, it literally looks like five skinny fingers.
Ew.
Yeah, it's actually like kind of crazy. And then there's land all around the lakes. And apparently it's really beautiful. I've never personally been there. Yeah, it's really beautiful, minus the murder that took place there in 1985. So I just wanted to set up the scene for you all.
Oh my God, sorry. I'm trying to look up the Finger Lakes.
That's okay.
And someone sent us a TikTok, and so it pulled up. So, sorry, I just want to find what the Finger Lakes look like on the map.
Yeah, we'll definitely have to post a picture of it.
Ew, oh, you're right.
Yeah.
Oh, that's so creepy.
I know. And especially when you, like, hear about all the mysterious stuff that happens there, it just makes it even more creepy.
Yeah.
But that being said, yes, I know it's a very nice vacation area, but every place has hidden secrets.
Oh.
So despite Ovid being a quiet, beautiful town, there's a 35-year-old cold case that still haunts this small town in the Finger Lakes. In August of 1985, Kristen O'Connell was a 20-year-old rising junior at the University of Wisconsin-Stout, where she was studying hotel and restaurant management. On a personal note, I actually studied hospitality management.
I was literally just about to ask you that.
Yeah. So, I mean, it's pretty much the same major as what she studied, and it's not super common. So right away, like, I kind of felt a connection to her because we clearly had similar interests. Also, I'm not too far off age-wise from Kristen when all of this happened.
How old was she again?
She was 20.
Oh, man.
Yeah. Yeah, I definitely felt a connection to her as I started researching this story. Kristen was in Ovid visiting a young man that she met while on spring break.
Oh, both mm-hmm. of our stories involve spring break.
Yeah. One night, she was at a party with about a dozen friends in a trailer, also similar to the one situation.
Yeah, the Colin Gillis.
Yeah. She was staying at the trailer with friends during her stay in Ovid, so I'm guessing they were just drinking, having fun.
As you do during spring break.
Exactly, and all in like a private area. The trailer was located behind a restaurant called the Golden Buck Restaurant. That night, which was August 14th, 1985, around 11:30 p.m., Kristen went for a walk alone and left the trailer.
Never. Never.
I know. And that was the last time anyone ever saw her alive.
Oh, my God.
Her naked body was found in a cornfield along County Road 139 in Ovid, about a third of a mile up the road from the trailer she was staying in. Mm. She was found stabbed to death and her throat was slashed.
Oh, my God.
Yeah. There's photos of the crime scene, and even to this day, it looks rural and, like, really eerie mm-hmm. when you look at the pictures.
Did you look at them?
I did.
Was it creepy?
It was creepy. It was, like, deserted. There was nothing around.
Oh, my gosh.
I'm guessing the trailer isn't there anymore.
Mm-hmm.
It was an eerie feeling.
Yeah.
And it's just an open field with some trees.
I don't like that.
I don't either.
And I don't like that at all.
I know. No arrests were ever made in her murder.
Sorry.
Kristen's mom, Phyllis.
Sorry.
That's what it says to do on the internet when you mess up so you can see the like lines move differently. Okay, I'm sorry. Kristen's mom, Phyllis, lives in Minnesota, where Kristen was born and raised. Phyllis has made it her life's mission to find the person who killed her daughter.
Oh.
Yeah. Phyllis was interviewed by Channel 10. I'm sorry, I said 11 earlier. It's Channel 10 News in Rochester back in 2019. And she said, quote, "Everybody liked Kristen. She was a good soul and good-hearted. We were extremely close as mother and daughter," end quote. Her mother also stated she believed something had happened to Kristen and Ovid before the murder because she called her mom and told her that she was coming home. But she was murdered shortly after that phone call, so her mom never got the details of what was happening.
Oh, yeah. Oh, I can't even imagine.
I know. Something else. Her mom's going to have to live with that for the rest of her life. Maybe she should have given or could have given her some advice or something.
And just always wondering what she was going to say.
Exactly. Kristen was missing for 2 days before her body was found. Which is, to me, crazy because she was only a third mile away.
Yeah.
So, and I couldn't really find, I mean, they were just looking for her.
Mm-hmm.
There's no explanation as to why it took 2 days when she was so close, but it was 2 full days.
And was she, like, was her body hidden or was it, like, relatively out in the open?
Well, it was in a cornfield.
So, like, were the stalks, like, high at the time?
It didn't say. I mean, I'm guessing if it took 2 days, they hopefully it was, you know, they were high rather than they didn't. I mean, the corn stalks were high.
Yeah.
Rather than, you know, they just didn't look hard enough.
Yeah.
But I'm guessing it was a pretty, you know, bushy area, hard to see.
Dang.
While she was still missing, her dad flew to Ovid from Minnesota to help with the search. But shortly after he arrived, they found her body and had to tell him the awful news in person. Her dad has since passed away, but I imagine the news was earth-shattering for him.
And just think, he passed away without ever knowing what happened to his daughter.
Exactly. And he later said of his daughter, quote, "She was very trusting of people, and I wouldn't want to change a bit."
Aww.
So to me, that means, like, that's who she was.
Yeah.
If something happened, you know, it's not her fault for being herself, for being a woman.
And do you think maybe it was someone she knows? Because if she was very trusting, like she would, you would assume she's more trusting with her friends. So do you think it was someone she knew?
I definitely think it was someone she knew.
Ugh.
It's so hard to tell, but I did not find any information that there was any like sexual motive.
Oh, well, that's good at least.
Yeah, but that also tells you that it was probably personal, whether someone she knew or someone who sent someone to do it.
Oh, yeah.
So here we are 35 years later, and Kristen's case remains unsolved. So Rochester's Channel 10 News, which, by the way, like I said, that's about the only news station that talks about this case, because I guess they're the only ones that care to discuss it.
Yeah.
They met with state police investigator George Gerbic.
Nailed it.
Thank you. And he says that it's still an active investigation. I just want to note that, yes, it's still active, but the police have had over 2,000 leads and no arrests have ever been made.
Do you know if they followed up on all of those leads? Because that's a lot.
I mean, they've followed up. They've done as much as they can, like, from what I've read.
Oh.
Yeah, it's a lot of leads. And Gerbic says, I believe it was a very violent encounter. I believe Kristen fought back violently as well as, and ultimately, I think that might have been motivated. I can't laugh. Y'all, I cannot talk today. Like, this is such a serious case, and I am stumbling over my words like no other. I think the Tylenol is, like, messing with my vision or something. I don't know if that's a thing, but I'll just go with that.
Never heard it before, but okay. You know.
But Gerbic says, I believe it was a very violent encounter. I believe Kristen fought back violently as well, and ultimately, I think that might have motivated this person to silence her. Evidence collected at the crime scene has been saved, and now investigators are running new tests that will hopefully solve the case. It seems that as advances in DNA technology come out, they retest the evidence, hoping that the new technology will pick something up. Kristen's brother, Kyle, is hopeful that with all the technological advances, the family hasn't given up hope that the killer will be found. Because remember, the first case I did with Timothy, he was the first DNA case. So at the time of Kristen's murder, they did not have the technology to process the DNA. They do now, and we'll get a little bit more into that.
And they did find DNA on her?
They did find DNA, but they are not able to do anything with it. I don't know if they're not able to match it in the system or it's not clear enough to test. I think the issue is that it's not clear enough to test, though, mm-hmm. because they keep trying it on new technology as new technology comes out.
And especially with it being on her for 2 days, like, that's 2 days in the elements. That's 2 days with animals and wind and whatever else could have been there.
And anyone trying to hide mm-hmm. any evidence, yeah.
And it always – it's just so cool, too, how, like, DNA can be saved from, like, the 1980s and then be used 40 years later or, like yeah. you said, 35 years later and still – be able to be tested.
Yeah, and that DNA can still exist even if the person isn't alive.
Yeah.
Like, that whole concept, it seems simple, but it's like, you know, she's still here in a way.
Yeah.
So what police do know is that the night Kristen disappeared, witnesses spotted her walking. They also saw two men walking behind her. One of the men was described as 6 foot to 6 foot 2 inches with shoulder-length hair, wearing blue jeans and possibly a jean jacket. The other man was shorter with brown hair and a thin build. Those two men have never been identified.
That gives me anxiety. I get anxiety when I'm, like, walking Roy outside Same. And, like, someone makes a noise behind me or I hear someone walking behind me and it's, like, the middle of the day.
I know. And I picture, like, her just – she at some point had to have realized they were behind her and realizing she was walking away from her friends.
Oh my God, that, like, my heart's pounding. That gives me such anxiety thinking about how she felt.
I know. Rochester's Channel 10 News actually released two stories about Kristen's murder in 2019. After the first one aired, recognizing the almost 35 years since her murder, a man named George Zammit came forward to the news and told them that he was questioned by police 5 years ago about Kristen's murder. So that was 2019, so that would have been 2014. Mm-hmm. He was questioned by police. He claims that he had never met Kristen a day in his life and that he was being set up. He also told the news, quote, I can't tell you where I wasn't, but I can't tell you where I was. I wasn't killing anybody. Okay, George, not sure what you're saying.
So did he just, like, randomly come out just, like, 5 years later and was like, yo, I got questioned?
Well, he saw the news story. So, and to me, it's like, why would you even come forward if you have nothing to do with
exactly.
it? Why would you want that attention on you?
Exactly.
Because now here I am discussing it mm-hmm. because you felt the need to talk about how you didn't do anything.
It's like one of those things where if you're trying to convince someone so hard that you didn't do something, chances are it's because, like, you feel guilty or there's a reason why you feel the need that you have to defend yourself or something that you claim you didn't do.
Exactly. And there's so little information about this case online that I could have researched this and never known about this George guy because it wasn't anywhere else.
Dang.
So I'm just saying, I'm not accusing him of anything. I'm just saying that
it's weird.
I don't know why he would have felt the need to go to the news, who then interviewed him, just for him to say I wasn't involved.
Yep.
George's stepsister named Lori actually told investigators back in 2014 that she remembered seeing George with blood on his clothes around the time of Kristen's death.
Excuse me.
Yeah, you wonder why you're being questioned, George.
Or did she, like, go to the cops?
Well, she waited almost 20 years before going to anyone. Or it would have been almost 30 years. Excuse me. I did not major in math. So it would have been about almost 30 years.
That's still just suspicious that she wouldn't have said anything before this.
I completely agree. I don't know if maybe she was scared of him or, you know, it could have been anything.
Or, you know, protecting your brother. Like, exactly. I get it, but still at the same time, like, a girl was killed.
I know. George claims that the blood was from killing a pig for a pig roast.
Oh, yeah, that checks out, yep.
Yeah, and why would you walk around with blood all over your clothes
yep.
after that? Like, that's really suspicious to have all that blood on you.
And it seems like if you are doing a pig roast, you've probably done them before.
Exactly.
So you know how messy it would be. So I can just imagine you'd have, like, an apron or a spare set of clothes. I mean, I've never done a pig roast, so I could be completely wrong about this, but that's just kind of what I'm assuming.
Right. And I don't think – I just think the timing of when he did this pig roast is just really interesting.
Yeah.
How close it was to her death.
Yeah.
But after being questioned, George spray painted a message to state police on a fence that said, quote, please stop playing cop games. We had a pig roast. Lori lied.
Do you think, so you know how some people call cops pigs?
Mm-hmm.
Do you think that could be anything? Because he, like, wrote this letter to the cops about a pig roast. Like, do you think that could, like, be anything?
Like a message to them?
Yeah, kind of like, I don't know. Like, you know, he claimed that it was a pig roast, and then the cops are, like, on his tail because of it. And so he writes a note to cops saying that it was a pig roast. Like, I don't know. It's just,
maybe.
Like,
that's a really interesting
weird
thought.
In my head.
Yeah, that, I mean, this guy, he things he says don't really seem to make sense, so maybe he did have a hidden meaning. That's a good point.
Thank you.
So he wrote this on the wall saying, we had a pig roast, Lori lied, which was interesting also because I thought he said he couldn't remember what he was doing that night.
Mm-hmm.
By the way, Lori was shot and killed in a double homicide in 2018.
Oh, my God.
Yeah. And I know what you're thinking. That's, like, also very interesting that this is happening. But someone was arrested and is serving life in prison for her murder.
Did that person and her brother have any connection at all?
No connection.
Oh.
Yeah.
Oh, geez, that was shocking.
I know, and I felt so bad. And honestly, I hope George feels bad for saying Lori lied.
Yeah.
Because Lori, from what I see, just said there was blood on him, which is the truth, apparently, if he had a pig roast, like he said. So back to George, he actually took a lie detector test and gave state police his DNA back in 2014 when he was questioned. He failed part of the lie detector test.
And I know those can't be used in court, and, like, they are kind of BS in these kinds of instances, but it is crazy when someone does fail.
Especially since so much time has passed, you would think that, you know, he wouldn't have issue passing it, even if he did it.
Yep.
Because he's had time to cope with it. And I'm saying if, I'm not saying he did.
Yeah. And, like, time to make himself believe that his story is true. Because a lot of times, like, people who are really good liars are able to pass these tests because they believe their lie so much that they're telling their truth.
Exactly.
And their truth is the truth that the lie detector is going to pick up as you're telling the truth.
Exactly. Yeah. So George says, quote, they say I failed one of the questions, that I know something. I'm thinking we all know something. That's a trick question, you know what I mean? But I passed the most important ones. Did I wear her blood? Did I kill her? I passed those questions, end quote. So he's saying that we all know something. I don't know something.
Yeah.
Do you?
No, I don't know.
I don't know what happened to her. Like, I reread that and I was like, maybe I'm not understanding, but
he is, sounds like a very kind of sketchy guy.
Yeah.
I don't like it.
So I think George knows something.
Yeah.
And Kristen's mom agrees with me.
Yeah.
Phyllis believes that there are probably a lot of people who know who did this, but just won't come forward, which I imagine is super infuriating for her. I mean, she lost her daughter and then her husband, and there could be people out there carrying information, but no one is coming forward. So investigator Gerbic is a little more optimistic in his interview with News 10. He said that he hopes evidence from the scene will break the case, which it has been 35 years. So I'm not sure what they're waiting, you know, for to break the case. But Gerbic also says that, quote, as advancements in forensic technology keep getting better and better, we keep retesting evidence that we have.
Good.
So that's what I'm thinking, is that they're just hoping that something will come out that'll be strong enough to test the DNA that they do have.
Yeah.
Which is a little nerve-wracking because, you know, I'm sure it's not helping that time is passing since when that happened. So investigators have definitely had their share of interesting suspects, like as I said, with everything with him. But Kristen's mom, Phyllis, is in regular contact with state police and also has a private investigator working the case.
Good for her.
Mm-hmm. When asked about the case all these years later, Phyllis said, quote, I'm not going anywhere. I will not rest. I will not give up.
Oh, what a good mom.
Yeah.
Oh, that's heartbreaking.
Mm-hmm. And I actually went on Facebook to see if there was a Facebook page for her, and there is.
Oh, okay.
And I'm pretty sure Phyllis runs it. Yeah, I can just tell from the posts, and she was posting a Pinterest that shows like all the evidence they have, and that was definitely Phyllis in the Pinterest.
Ugh.
But on the Facebook, it's like, it's just insane. You know, before we were even born, this happened.
Yeah.
And this woman has been fighting to find her daughter, or to find what happened, to find the killer, for so long. So if anyone knows anything about this case or anything about Kristen that could potentially be useful to the case, such as issues she was having with anyone, boy drama, friend drama, a fight with a stranger in the parking lot of Walmart, like anything, please contact New York State Police at 585-398-4300. Kristen's mother, Phyllis, is getting older, and she deserves to see her daughter's killers get locked up for their horrible crimes so she can finally have peace.
Oh.
Yeah.
Oh.
That was a hard one.
Yeah.
And it just felt like it did not get nearly enough attention.
No.
I mean, I there was nothing on this. So
that's why when I was looking, I don't know why I really wanted to cover a disappearance, and I could not find one that had a lot of information. Mm-hmm. So the fact that you were able to get that much information is really good.
Well, and it's crazy that we were kind of on the same wavelength with like, types of cases we did.
Yeah.
And I think at least, you know, even if we only have 10 listeners, that's 10 people who could potentially tell people.
Right.
You know?
Yeah, just anything to get the story out, especially to help her mom. Like, that's just, that's heartbreaking.
I know. And luckily, I think Kyle, her brother, is still alive. So the mom does have her brother, but it's still not fair.
Yeah.
So I hope that, you know, eventually someone gets arrested for this who did it. So.
Yeah, I mean, with any of these cases that we cover, we'll keep you guys updated. If we do find out any new leads or any new information comes to light, we'll definitely update about that.
Absolutely.
But in the meantime, if you guys want to reach out to us, give us any recommendations for cases you'd like to hear in your state, tell us any scary things that happen in your state, send us an email at ascarystatepodcast@gmail.com.
Or you can follow us on Instagram at @ascarystatepodcast.
And we are still in the process of setting up more social media. So once we do that, we'll report back with all of those handles as well. So in the meantime, stay scary.
Stay safe.
Bye.
Bye.